We now are joined by our monthly investigative journalist friend, Tony Gosling, who joins us now from the UK. Good morning, Tony.
Hi, Bill. I'm in Bristol.
Yeah, well, you see, it's still the UK.
Just about.
Although the Russians might have it otherwise, yeah. Tony, isn't it? Because it's quite close to Salisbury, so you never know.
Well, and also it's a remain a hotbed as well. As many of the big cities did, the actual inner city parts, the poorer parts of the country, voted to remain, and so there's this sort of tension which is being exploited by people who want to overturn the referendum, which is an interesting place to be, Bristol.
Did you enjoy Theresa May's dance yesterday as she went to the party conference?
I thought it was appalling. I mean, really, the Conservative Party are looking extremely thin, particularly if you look at the crowds. I was watching Sajid Javid, the Home Secretary's speech yesterday, about 30 people in there. The thing seems to be being presented to us via the mass media as a credible government, but when you actually poke below the surface, you find it's basically appointees, or rather like, in fact, the European Commission that the Conservative Party is pointing out is undemocratic. People often forget that Theresa May was not elected leader. She was stood against Andrew Leadsom, who then fell on her sword, so there was no election, so the Conservative Party members didn't get any vote to put a new leader in place. So they're just as unelected as the European Commission.
Interesting. And do you think personally, Tony, that kind of performance, although it showed a human side to Theresa May, was actually demeaning her respect in the community, given what's going on around her?
Yeah, it just looked to me like a bunch of PR people had sat around, public relations types, and said, look, what can we do to make her seem exciting, interesting? You know, because it was actually Boris Johnson that packed the hall. And it does seem as if her going for this Chequers plan is basically political suicide, because it keeps a lot of the people that put her in power, the deep state, the establishment that put her in power, keeps them happy. The Conservative Party members and actually the wider country don't go for it.
Interesting. Well, a big change of topic here, and this has kind of happened in the last 24 hours, and there's an extraordinary claim now which has been made by the British government, which is a precursor, apparently, we're told, to the announcement of further UK intelligence revelations of Russian state involvement in the poisoning in Salisbury of Sergei Skripal. And this is Jeremy Hunt, who has said that attacks widely known to have been conducted around the world were covers for the Russian GRU intelligence service, and they had been undertaken with the consent and knowledge of the Kremlin. Mr. Gosling, I'm sure you have a view on this.
Well, what I heard was Gavin Williams, the defence secretary, who's also there's very little credibility to him either. He's the guy that said, I think Vladimir Putin should shut up and go away.
Yes, I remember him.
Famously. Yeah. I've heard him saying this stuff about these various cyber attacks around the world. Well, first of all, let's have the evidence. Also, it's very easy to cloak a cyber attack. So what you do is you use a whole series of proxy servers in another country, and then in a superficial way, it looks as if that cyber attack is coming from that country where the proxy servers are.
Yep.
So there is a whole industry out there which has been cultivated for making it look as if a cyber attack is coming from one direction when really it's coming from another. So because of that, we absolutely have to see the proof. I'm afraid we can't just go on the word of Gavin Williams or anybody else about where a cyber attack has come from, and even if it's happened, because this is we're straying here into a very, very dangerous area, which he's not actually saying alongside this, which is that the NATO countries, the main NATO countries, the United States and the UK, have both said that if there is a cyber attack, then we can retaliate with nuclear weapons. So they see a cyber... I mean, of course, they're right. Right? Now, I don't actually agree with nuclear weapons at all, but what they're saying is, if there's a cyber attack on our infrastructure, that is to say things like electricity, energy supplies.
Yep.
There's a whole load of important stuff. The internet, taking the internet down.
Air traffic control would be another one, I guess.
Exactly. So it's potentially our And many of our systems now are extremely vulnerable. Yeah. Now we've gone on to this sort of digital world and everything's on the internet. Everything is also vulnerable. Bank accounts. I mean, you could see thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of bank accounts targeted, for example. Mm. You know, so if that happens, then the military doctrine is now, and this, I'm not kidding you, is what they're saying is that we can retaliate with nuclear weapons if we wish. So what they're saying is starting to up the ante against Russia, like they've done in the past with other countries such as, remember Saddam, remember Gaddafi, remember Assad.
Yeah.
You know, the latest country to be demonized is Russia. So I think, I don't believe a word of this unless they've got evidence which can be double checked by the experts in the field, that is people like the website The Register, there are others, Slashdot, you know, the real experts in the digital cyber world can look at this and say, well, actually, it looks like they're right here. Without the evidence, this, I'm afraid, is just a load of hot air.
Interesting stuff. Okay, thank you, Tony. That's a watch this space one. Now, something I hadn't planned to talk about, but you just told me that you were at the Arnhem celebrations this week, and a kind of unique viewpoint from you on that.
Well, you've just made a mistake that I made at one point when I was over there, calling it a celebration.
Right,
but it's an easy mistake to make.
Yes.
Right? This was a massive Allied defeat towards the end of the Second World War, up between D-Day and the end of the war. And the one of the reasons that the local Dutch people are a little bit unhappy over there is that it is turning into a celebration. It's turning into a sort of drinking party with all the jolly good chaps getting drunk, and there's a lot of revelry. It's getting bigger and bigger every year. And this is one of the conundrums of the Arnhem Battle, is that despite the fact that actually it was a decisive Nazi victory, the celebrations every year are getting bigger and bigger and bigger. In fact, they even have big performances. So they'll have kind of massive stage performances. That's usually on the Friday or the Saturday evening. This year it was all rain. Well, it still went on, but it was pouring with rain the whole way through, and they couldn't actually do this parachute drop that they were going to do
right.
as part of the celebrations, because the locals are saying it should not be a celebration, it should simply be a solemn commemoration. And I totally agree with them. There is actually a solemn commemoration that happens on the Sunday as a service at the War Grave Cemetery, but the whole thing is turning into this sort of drinking party, which they don't like. And the reason for that is because it was a Nazi victory. That's one of the reasons that the locals are saying that they don't want that to happen. But my research into that battle has proven, really beyond any doubt, it's not just my research, it's the research of many people, including military historian Tim Saunders, who's written the best book on the Nijmegen part of the battle. That was a little bit further down the road. To put it in context, the film A Bridge Too Far puts it all out there for people. If they've never seen that film, I would suggest you have a watch of it, because it's a terrific war film, and it is pretty accurate in that it shows the various problems. For example, the guys at Arnhem were defeated. It was just a small bunch of British paratroopers at Arnhem Bridge. The only problem was the British could have easily come to relieve them. The tanks could have easily come to relieve them, but they sat and waited, and they waited and waited for hours and hours and hours, where there was nothing in between them and Arnhem, until an hour after the British had been defeated, and then they started to move forward towards Arnhem. Now, there's a lot of people locally are extremely sceptical about whether the higher-ups in the British Army actually wanted to win this battle.
Wow.
The main question is, why would they want to throw the battle? Why would someone at the top, say, for example, General Browning, want to throw the battle? But the thing I've discovered is that just a month before, the British were already at the top starting to do deals with the Nazis, because the Nazis had a fantastic amount of money. They also had enriched uranium.
Mm-hmm.
And that the Allies, certain people at the top of the Allies, really wanted to get hold of this money and uranium, and so they were starting to do deals. Now, what the delay of the end of the Battle of Arnhem would have meant for the war was an extra 4 months of war, because they reckoned everybody involved in it was saying that the war could be over by Christmas if we win this, and it left an extra few months then for the Nazis to squirrel away their wealth. Now, it might sound like a fantastical conspiracy theory, but I was amazed, Bill, to see that there are actually people over there who live, whose parents lived through the battle or grandparents lived through the battle, who have similar concerns about, number one, the way that the celebrations in Arnhem are going every year, and number two, about the British's actual willingness to win the battle. And of course, because they didn't win, it led to a massive sacrifice of British soldiers who were surrounded by tanks. Remember, the paratroopers are very lightly armed. Yep. So this is an example, I think, of something that we can learn a little bit from history. And also, the Dutch were absolutely adamant that they didn't want this kind of party atmosphere at the annual commemoration to continue. They want that to finish because they don't believe it's at all appropriate.
Ah, well, I didn't know half that stuff, Tony. That's very interesting indeed, as always. And from
lovely trip to Holland, by the way. It was absolutely beautiful over there.
Yes.
And I love Dutch. The whole Dutch is easygoing attitude. You know, one of the things they said to me I found fascinating and lovely, which was, well, we're not very nationalistic in Holland. We're so used to being invaded.
Wow. I know, it's lovely, but I love Holland. It's a lovely place. Nice people, too, as you say. Now, a completely different subject, but a kind of war of sorts, and this is that the lawyer for Christine Blasey Ford is condemning President Donald Trump for mocking his client, who, of course, said she was sexually assaulted by Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh when they were teenagers. Trump's behaviour was extraordinary, wasn't it?
Well, yes, but I think he's right in a way, because he's saying here, let's have a innocent till proven guilty, please. I mean, Trump is bringing in all sorts of measures. I must say, probably for me, one of the worst things he's done is to pull out of this climate agreement. Mm. I think, you know, it's taken years and years to get that Paris agreement, and he's pulled out of that. So you almost feel like, you know, someone, a terrible bad person for saying he's done something right, you know. But I think, for example, with his trade barriers, this is what people voted for. When they voted for Trump, he said very, very clearly, I'm going to protect jobs in American steel by putting up trade barriers. He said that again and again. Yep. And so that's what people voted for. That's what he's doing. Now, the consequences may not be what people like, but, you know, that's what he said he'd do, and he's doing it. When it comes to Supreme Court nominees, now this is where you start to get the deep state potentially interfering. So his power as president should be to appoint these people. Now, when we see something dragged up from someone's past, I'm afraid I'm a rather cynical person. And I think, well, almost all of the people in these key and powerful positions have skeletons in their closet. It's just at certain occasions, the intelligence services, those that snoop, surveil, etc., they will bring out a whole load of evidence on somebody and say, well, this person is a terrible, evil person. But they're not bringing that information out about people who they like. Mm. So what they have, what they used to call, I can remember when I was working in London, they called it the Black Book. So what it means is that when there's somebody that they want to character assassinate at the top, they open the Black Book on that page, and there's a whole load of stuff in there which are either allegations, rumours, some of them may be facts, and these get literally thrown out to the public via the mass media in order to try and make sure that person doesn't get their appointment, etc. And I think that's what's going on here. It's almost, I mean, I would like to see a court case of some sort before there's any smears or any more slurs of this guilty until proven innocent nature, because that's what it seems to be, trial by television, and that's no way to do it. If this information was there, it should have been got out years ago, testimony should have been made years ago, and there should have been a court case about it where evidence was presented in the proper way. We can't have this kind of trial by TV, and in fact it seems, again, like with Theresa May, the whole system is being managed via the mass media rather than via the democratic process or via the courts.
Interesting. And finally, and this was something you put on your own Twitter feed, which I recommend anybody, if you're on Twitter, to follow Tony's Twitter feed. There's some fascinating stuff on there. And that was the former Bank of England Governor, Lord Mervyn King, who talked about the £166 trillion time bomb.
Yeah, this is the debt overhang. Okay, so this is where we are now, Bill. We've got, I think, you know, we the mass media doesn't talk about this, and it's not censorship, it's self-censorship. So when the journalists know what they're not supposed to talk about, we talk about it on the radio here in Bristol, you talk about it there, but there are, in the mass media here in Britain, there's lots of taboos, you have to call them, blind yep. spots. One of them is the extent of QE. In the Eurozone and the pound zone, the quantitative easing is basically counterfeiting. So it's printing money. It's saying to some bank, like the Bank of England or the European Central Bank, you can just print as much money as you want, and it's based on nothing. It's just paper or electronic money. And they're doing this at an incredible rate at the moment, which is a form of counterfeiting. So the bank has a license to do it. If you were to do it, you'd go to jail. So the amounts of QE are stupendous at the moment. And I had to work quite hard to do the research to find out what they are. We're talking about 1 trillion euros a year is being made up out of nowhere and then spent into the economies of Europe by the European Central Bank. Wow. Mario Draghi, I mean, you know, Dragon is an easy way to remember his name, Draghi. And in the UK with Mark Carney, who, by the way, is responsible for the financial crisis. I'm not sure if you knew that. The 2008 financial crisis was the responsibility of Mark Carney, who was the he was the chair of the regulation committee at the Bank for International Settlements, which is the international bank, the central banker's central bank. So he was in charge of regulating banking in the run-up to the financial crisis in 2008 and the bailouts. So, you know, this guy should not be the governor of the Bank of England. But that aside, he's making up, out of nowhere, counterfeiting, if you like, £100 billion a year and spending that into, not into the economy, but he's spending it by propping up banks and big business. So what they do is they use it to keep the share prices higher. And 80% of that goes to the banks, this money created out of nowhere. So that's 80 billion, and 20 billion goes to big companies. So that's the background to this 166 trillion debt overhang. So what we've got is we've got a whole load of businesses. If you look at their balance sheet, you will find the assets are massively overvalued. And what that means really is that the money that is there will never be paid. It's just a figure on a sheet. But it can't, if you're actually trying to realize those assets, you will never manage to get the money that it says on the balance sheet. So we're looking at a colossal, I suppose you call it accounting fraud, isn't it? I mean, that's what. This, of course, is all criminal. So what the all the auditors that are auditing these accounts and signing them off are doing is criminal. So we're looking at an absolutely enormous mass crime, a kind of groupthink in the financial sector. And of course, the reason they do it is pretty simple, really, is because they're getting paid to do it. They're getting paid to sign off all those accounts. And if they don't sign them off, then there's all the likelihood that they won't be asked back next year to do the auditing again. So I think Mervyn King, he's actually, I think, a very sweet chap, actually. I mean, you know, I like him. I trust him because he was on the TV again this week. I think it was on BBC Two doing a program about the, 10 years since the collapse of Lehman Brothers and the financial crisis. And he just comes across as a very down-to-earth, honest guy. Carney, I'm afraid. Is more like a sort of Dracula figure. I see him as at the top because he's not being straight with us. I suppose he would probably say, well, I can't because it's not my job to be straight and honest with people. It's my job to tell people and the politicians what they want to hear.
Watch this space again. And that all of that and more you can find on Tony's Twitter feed. And if you just Google Tony Gosling, you'll find all kinds of interesting stuff. Tony, thank you so much. Appreciate it. We will speak to you again next month, sir.
Lovely to chat again.
All the best. Cheers, Tony. Bye-bye.